The porch light's on. The door's open. Come on into the meat house. Around the table tonight, we have J.D. Webb, Mississippi Chris Spencer, Aaron Martin, Jeff Schaus is in the house. I am Ryan Richardson, and joining us tonight is Carlos Bassetti from Superstition Meadery. We're happy to have Carlos with us. He's moving a little slow, though. He's weighted down by all those Mazer Cups he keeps winning. We'll get into that in a few minutes. He brought some mead with him, so we'll skip what are we drinking. I sent the boys a few bottles. They'll give me their feedback, and we'll talk about those. And JD's got something that looks like the surface of Mars going on. We'll get into that a little later. Before we start, Jeff usually takes a look around the Facebook world and lets us know what he found. Jeff, what do you got?
So I've got a few different posts that I noticed this week here. Just recently, Brent Hensley posted a question about whether or not people had experimented with bog myrtle, which is another herb. And just looking into this, it seems like it falls into that category of things like dandelion and sweet woodruff and other things that used to be used kind of as a bittering agent, like hops are, before they were all supplanted by hops, which just works much better. And that kind of just got my interest there, because that's one of those things that I've been trying to play with a little bit. I've got some sweet woodruff growing in my garden, actually, that I'm going to plan on experimenting with this year. But I was wondering if you guys had any experience with any of these other weird herbs or anything like that on your end.
Not unless they went into a soup I was making or something. No. Ryan, you had something?
No, never done anything like that.
Nor have I.
I was gonna pop in. We made a sizer with mugwort, and it turned out really nice. And we fermented it in the batch with Arizona honey and Arizona apples, and we actually had to send a sample off to the government so they could test the thujone content. And mugwort might not be, you know, exactly like what they're talking about, but I think that might be pretty similar, and it turned out really nicely.
Yeah, it sounds like it's kind of in that same idea. Now, the thujone content, that's kind of like along the same ideas as wormwood you would find in absinthe, right?
Exactly.
Was there an appreciable amount of the mugwort?
You know, the government didn't tell us how much was in there, but we had to be below 10 parts per million. Okay. So we know there's less than 10 parts per million. But yeah, they wouldn't tell us how much was in there.
What kind of a flavor does mugwort impart to a mead?
It was a really nice kind of herbal character, a little bit woody, kind of helped balance out a little sweetness, provided a little bitterness, kind of gave a really nice character. And I think we used about 2 ounces per gallon in the fermentation, just kind of in a bag.
Cool.
Oh, that's really interesting. I had one other Facebook post that I had wanted to highlight here. Conrad Wheeler was talking about, was putting together a couple batches, and he was using a product called Welch's Deliciously Simple. Now, that's not why I wanted to give him a shout-out here, though. He actually had a kind of a brilliant way of handling. You guys have all done with the aggressive fermentation, the blow-off tube instead of the just an airlock. What he did that I thought was inspired, he had a little like a Gatorade bottle that was basically just tacked on with the wire handle for his fermenting vessel, and he used that to hold that in place so that it was one self-contained unit with the blow-off tube. I thought that was really great, so I wanted to give him a shout-out for that.
I came across one that I think is worth pointing out. This was by Christopher Clark in the Mead Makers group. He posted a beautiful photograph of a dark beverage in a tulip glass next to some s'mores. You know, it looks like a food stylist did this, so that's a campfire snack, a s'more. And he says this is a 15.1% Boucher Braggot. Slow roasted the honey until tar black for 3.5 hours, added to an imperial milk stout base, fermented out and aged on graham crackers, cacao nibs, cinnamon bark, and vanilla bean.
Graham crackers.
Yep, I got something to add to the graham cracker debate once we get to talking about some more recipe formulation. That's something that's, I'll give you a little hint. Remember the Metafoam honey we tasted from Worker Bee?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be a s'mores mead.
I can't wait.
Yeah, it's already in the works.
Joining us tonight, our guest, Carlos Pacetti from Superstition Meadery. Welcome to the show, Carlos.
Thank you.
You brought some, or sent us some bottles actually ahead of time so that we could sip these. And we all got a different bottle. We were all talking about them a little bit. I think we all had a couple of questions, and a good place to start might be just asking you about your process or what you did to achieve what you've got here.
Yeah. I can't remember what we sent you all, but, yeah, shoot.
Well, why don't we start, Aaron, why don't we start, with you?
Sounds good. So I am enjoying a glass of this War Honey. This is a hopped lemon flavored mead, checking in at 13.5% ABV. Very delightful. This is, I have to say, I'm kind of drinking this in reverse order. Normally, you know, you pour yourself a glass of something cold and you let it kind of warm up over time and notice how the flavor changes. And I kind of did that opposite. This just got delivered here earlier today. So as soon as the box got here, I popped it open and eagerly poured myself a glass, just a little bit warm, enjoyed the first couple sips of it warm, then popped that glass in the freezer, and that's what I'm finishing right now is the chilled. And it's really interesting the change that occurs to this mead as the temperature changes. But that's what I've got is the War Honey.
Okay. Yeah, so would you like to kind of know about the process we use for that one?
Yes, absolutely. I have some experience using hops and meads, and I'm definitely curious to know, you know, how did you introduce those? How did you introduce the lemons? And if you don't mind, maybe just walk us through a little bit of the background on this recipe.
For sure. So this mead uses Arizona wildflower honey. And so after the fermentation, we will, we zest the lemons. We don't use lemon juice. And we use something called a rotato. And so it's meant to like peel potatoes. But you pop the lemon on there and turn it on and it just gets the zest off. So we don't get any of that white pith, which can introduce some bitterness. And so we use Arizona lemon zest, and then for War Honey, we use Simcoe and Citra hops. And we throw those in a bag so that we can get them out of the tank easier. And then we're basically just dry hopping for 2 to 3 days with the hops and the lemons staying there for about the same amount of time. And we just kind of let it age on those ingredients until the taste is where we like it.
Interesting. You know, this is a really fascinating drink to me. When I was enjoying it at a little bit warmer of a temperature, I was actually enjoying a glass with my brother-in-law, and neither of us were really getting much of a lemon character at all. We were both commenting on how it had kind of a tropical fruit type of flavor coming through with, you know, some pineapple notes and maybe some mango notes. Then once we popped it in the freezer and chilled it off, then that lemon just came back and it just kind of smacked us in the face with a little bit more lemony type of a flavor. almost a white wine kind of character, like a Moscato or a Riesling, but really a fantastic brew there. So you were saying that you just dry hopped the hops with any of your other meads or with any of your other experience with hops. Have you ever boiled the hops prior to adding?
So we haven't. That's something we'd like to try doing. But we're set up. Our process is all cold. We don't heat anything. So we would like to try to make a mead kind of like, you know, traditional IPA, boiling the hops, doing the bittering additions and aroma additions. But we just haven't had the opportunity to do that because it's a little trickier for us to kind of get that set up, and we wouldn't be able to do it on a large scale. So that's something that we want to try sometime in the future. We just haven't had time to get around to it yet.
Could imagine that would be...
I don't personally have any experience with, you know, boiling hops in mead.
Gotcha. Interesting. I can imagine that would be much more difficult on a larger commercial scale. A few weeks or months ago, we circulated a couple of meads around the table of some hopped meads that I had done, where we boiled them. And, you know, I got to say, I think from what I'm tasting here and comparing it to those meads, I think with the dry hopping, I'm getting a much more subtle hop character. And I noticed that you said that one of the hops was Citra. Am I correct in thinking that's more of like a citrusy, fruity type of a hop?
Yeah, it's kind of a fruity, tropical sort of hop.
Okay. What went into your thought process when, you know, looking at different hops to use and making your selection?
We know we drink a lot of beer.
Yay!
You're in good company.
As the thing goes. It takes a lot of good beer to make a good wine or a good mead. So we drink a lot of beer and we drink a lot of IPAs, and you know, those are two hops that we really like. We enjoy, you know, IPAs with those beers, and we just kind of thought they would go Citra.
Citra, yeah. Okay.
What's that, Chris?
Yeah, and so we just thought those two hops would go well with lemon. And, you know, like most of the things we do, the first time we do something, we like to make a small test batch. And so that's, you know, going from homebrewing to a large scale commercial, it's, you know, kind of different. Because for us, a small test batch is 15 gallons of mead. And at our scale, 15 gallons, if we mess up, that's, at this point, that's pretty low consequence for us. Which is kind of crazy after, you know, coming from making 5 gallon batches and that being a big deal. So, you know, when we first made this, you know, we made 15 gallons, we threw the lemon peel in, we threw the different hops in, and this mead, actually the concept, Jen Herbert, Jeff Herbert, the owner's wife, and she's one of the owners too. She came up with the concept for a lemon hopped mead for the first time we made it.
Aaron, well, did this inspire you to try adding a little lemon zest to your hop meads?
It definitely does. It definitely does. You know, and I think it's also inspired me to look at hops a little bit differently as well. You know, I look at the ones that I circulated around the table those several weeks ago, and they were lighter bodied, they were carbonated, and more of what I would describe as kind of more of a session style mead, whereas this is quite sweet. I'm not sure what the final gravity of this was, but I would definitely describe this as being more of a wine style or dessert style type of a mead. And it's making me realize that, you know, hops are versatile and they work in that style just as much as in the session style as well. You know, if I may just ask one last question, and, you know, this is maybe a debate that the home mead maker runs into from time to time when making mead at home. What is your philosophy on leaving a mead this sweet? Do you typically like to, you know, finish your primary fermentation with some residual sweetness, or do you prefer to back sweeten afterwards by adding in some honey after the fact? What's kind of your philosophy there?
We typically finish the fermentation with some residual sweetness. And so, again, we have some different considerations, you know, as we're making 1,000-gallon batches of mead now. So it's significantly easier for us to add that honey up front at the beginning of fermentation because, you know, adding a little extra honey into a 5-gallon batch after fermentation is finished, you know, that's really easy. But adding, you know, 55 gallons of honey into a 1,000-gallon batch after the fermentation is complete is a whole different story. You know, you have to worry now about getting that honey mixed in properly and, you know, maybe worry about introducing oxygen into the product. So we do that occasionally. It's usually on a little smaller scale on our kind of smaller batches, you know, specialty stuff. You know, we just made a mead that we fermented with Belgian dark candy syrup and then back sweetened with caramelized honey. And so when we back sweeten with honey or with something else, you know, we've kind of got a specific goal in mind. We're not necessarily going for just sweetness, but we want, you know, to get a specific flavor out of that addition.
That makes sense. Well, thank you for the info, and thank you for sharing this mead. This is just phenomenal and really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, a pleasure.
Let's throw it over to Jeff. Jeff, did you have a chance to sample this before you went airborne?
Yeah, actually, I had a glass last night, and I'm finishing up my bottle now. I got the blueberry white, and man, let me tell you, this is one luscious mead. I think this falls under, I think, what we were talking about with some of Chris's stuff, where you can tell it has a lot of body. It has a really delicious tannin character that gives it some dryness, but there's also a lot of like blueberry sweetness in here, just from the fruit itself and the honey. It's a really interesting, really delightful mead.
Thank you.
So just tell us a little bit about this mead, Carlos.
So I can't reveal the white chocolate ingredient. Unfortunately, that's kind of our one trade secret. But I can kind of tell you about the rest of the process.
Sure.
So with these, and you know, we have the four meads that are kind of part of the white series. So we have the blueberry, which was the original, and then the berry, which is raspberry, which came next. And then we've also got strawberry and blackberry. So with all of these, we start with a mead, and, you know, we're shooting for a pretty high residual sweetness. You know, it's got a lot of body. And then we'll add the fruit in kind of at the end of fermentation, so that we retain a lot of that really kind of bright, fresh, intense fruit character. And then we'll, you know, age it on a ton of vanilla. Then we'll add our secret ingredient, and then we'll age it in New American oak barrels. And
no,
so I think, sorry.
When you say you're aging on vanilla, can you tell us, are you using beans and are you splitting those or scraping them? What's the process on the vanilla?
So we use whole beans and we haven't found it necessary to cut them or scrape them. We just add them in whole. And we'll bag them up so that we can get them out without too much trouble. But other than that, we don't really process our vanilla.
You know, it's one of the things that I really like about the show, Carlos, is that we get to talk to mead makers, and the one thing that is consistent is how inconsistent or different they are in their methods.
Yeah.
You know, we talked to a mead maker once who said that after trying all different kinds of beans, he now prefers to use, you know, vanilla extract. And it's so different to hear everybody. And that's, I think, what we really enjoy about the craft is that there's a lot of white space out there.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, everybody comes up with a different way of doing things, and, you know, you kind of just get into the groove and keep doing what works. And we definitely do that, but part of our philosophy is also always trying new things and always questioning whether or not the way we're doing something is the best way, and trying new things. And if they work better, then we'll completely change our process. If we think that, we can make a better mead, or, you know, we can improve our process.
Jeff, any additional questions or thoughts on your luscious beverage?
Yeah. Well, if I could just ask, would you give me at least a ballpark on the starting and final gravity on this? Because it feels like it has a lot of, and not necessarily the residual sugar, but there's a lot of body to it, which makes me think there's a pretty substantial amount there. I'm just trying to get a sense of where you're starting from with this, and maybe also the amount of fruit per gallon you're putting into this, because it's a really, really pronounced flavor.
Yeah, so... with this, we don't use whole fruit. We use fruit juice. Okay. And so I can't remember off the top of my head how much fruit juice it is, but it might be up to a quarter gallon of juice per gallon of mead.
Yeah, Jeff, I'll give you a rundown on that when I do my mead here.
Can you...
It's a lot of fruit.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine if Carlos went by what Chris often suggests, you know, that 6-7 pounds per gallon thing that he sometimes likes to use? Can you imagine 1,000 gallons of blueberry mead? You know what the cleanup would be like?
You'd need a tractor trailer full of blueberries just to do one batch of Chris's recipe.
That's why I'm an amateur.
I'm picturing Chris standing there with a scoop shovel and a bucket, man. I'm telling you.
And I think that's one of the great things about doing stuff at home on a small scale. You can do stuff that if you scaled up to 1,000 gallons would be impossible. And on the other end of that, you know, as a, you know, kind of a professional operation, we have the opportunity to do things that, you know, home mead makers would never be able to do. You know, we can age the same mead in 4 different types of barrels and then blend it all back together to get something really unique, you know, and you need, you know, 200 plus gallons of mead to do that.
Well, moving over to Chris, Mississippi, what'd you get?
I got the Marion. It's a blackberry, blueberry, raspberry. My wife said she got more blueberry. I thought I was getting more blackberry out of it. We tried it at room temperature. It's 13.5%. Very much along the lines of something I would make. Unlike Jeff and Aaron, I'm a quick draw artist with my hydrometer, so I do know the final gravity on it. And I won't say that on the air unless Carlos wants me to, but let me just test my knowledge of millimoles here. I'm going to say this was, there's probably anywhere from 25 to 30% juice in this. And that equates to somewhere between 3 and maybe 3.5 pounds of fruit per gallon, something like that. I'm going to say the blueberry, blackberry, and raspberry was in pretty much equal amounts or close to it.
That's correct.
Yeah. How am I doing so far?
You're doing pretty good.
I'm going to say about 30% juice, if you were using juice on this. And my question is, you can tell us a little bit about it and the history of it, but my main question is, what kind of yeast did you use on this?
Sorry, what kind of what?
What kind of yeast?
Oh, yeast. So we have a house yeast that we've kind of developed. It's like a white wine, and with this Marion, we also use another strain that we blend in. Primarily we're using white wine yeasts. They give us kind of, maybe I'd call it our kind of house character, that we really like, kind of neutral, and we really want to let, the ingredients shine, the honey and the fruit and all the spices. So we've kind of settled on a relatively neutral yeast, because we're not looking for a ton of character from that.
Now, when you blend the yeast, you say, are you pitching both at the same time, or are you fermenting the juice with one and the honey with the other and then blending them? Or walk us through that process.
So it's taken us a while to kind of get to this, but now we just pitch both yeasts at the beginning of fermentation. And we've experimented with a lot of different things, pitching a different yeast, a day or two in, or, after the gravity's dropped a little bit. But we've kind of settled on, and it's the easiest thing, which is convenient, just pitching them both at the beginning. It works really well for us. And that's something we'll do for our higher alcohol stuff as well. Because we still want kind of the contribution from our house yeast, but it doesn't ferment above 14% very well. So we'll also pitch kind of a more alcohol tolerant strain in conjunction with that.
This is very much along the lines of something that I would make, and it's a good example of how you go about using tart fruit. Basically, I see it as there's three options. You can use a lot of fruit and leave plenty of residual sweetness. That's option one, to balance it out. Option two is to make a more session strength hydromel, where you don't use nearly as much fruit, and that leaves you the option of going a lot drier. And option number three is to go through a malolactic fermentation if you want it drier. And I don't think this one was, this one just pretty much fermented out straight and left residual sweetness. Is that right?
Yeah. So we don't do any malolactic fermentations.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I didn't think this one was, because it's got too much residual sweetness, but very well balanced. It doesn't come across as sweet to me at all. Although to a dry wine drinker, it probably would, but
yeah,
this is good stuff.
Thank you. Yeah, that's definitely one of our most popular products.
Mm-hmm. I can see why.
Let's throw it over to JD. JD, you were talking a little bit pre-show, but why don't you tell us what you got and what you're getting out of it?
Yeah, I think Ryan probably sat there in anguish for a couple of days over who should get this coffee Marion mead, me or Chris, because Chris and I are both kind of the two coffeeholics on the show, I guess. So I could see Ryan just pulling his hair out, wondering, who am I going to send this to? Well, I got it. And this is And now, don't get me wrong. This is in a good way. This is probably the strangest mead I've ever tasted. it's good. I like the, there's a tartness, and it's kind of growing. I wasn't sure about it early on. We were talking pre-show. I wasn't quite sure about this, but as I continue to sip this, now I'm sipping room temperature. And it's a little cool in here, so room temperature is probably about 70 degrees. I don't know that I would drink it any colder than that, but this, I get this tartness coming from the berry. You take that first sip and you get that instant tart, and here's the coffee. And it finishes dry. And I was telling the boys, it's not like a dry wine dry. It's almost like a towel dry. And I think that's the coffee in it that gives you that sensation of dryness. But the lingering taste goes right back to the tart of the Marionberry. Now, I would enjoy, I think, a glass of this after dinner, because I sometimes like a nice dark roasted cup of coffee after dinner. I would have a little short glass of this after dinner, I think, too. Very good. And my question, Carlos, you know, we've been around the horn, the five of us, trying to come up with a coffee mead. Ryan sent out three of his concoctions, and that's going to be another episode too, I think. But how did you get the coffee in this? Whole bean crushed? Fermentation, secondary, how did you impart that coffee flavor in this mead?
So we do all the coffee post-fermentation, and we like to use whole beans. We don't crush them or anything. You know, we'll just throw them in a bag and toss them in a mead, and then we're typically aging that in the mead for about 3 days, and that gets us to where we like it. And I believe that batch was aged on an espresso blend from Mostra Coffee in San Diego. And we work with them for a lot of our coffee. They make really fantastic stuff, and they work with a lot of craft brewers and craft producers. And they
what coffee house did you say?
Mostra in San Diego.
Is that the one down at the winery?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I might be mistaken, but go ahead.
Yeah. So they do the coffee. They do a lot of coffee for Stone, for some of their beers, for the last year's Chocovesa, I believe. So they're kind of, they get out there a lot in kind of the craft beverage community. And, a lot of times we'll come to them with an idea for a mead and just let them choose, you know, what they think will be the best coffee to kind of go with those flavors.
I was just going to ask you, how do you arrive? That seems to be a process that, in trying to develop a coffee mead, not that, you know, I don't know how many of the five of us are done doing a coffee thing, but I'm going to give it one more college try. And you know, we start out just tasting coffee hot. Well, hot coffee is not what we're looking at. We're actually looking at the bean, the flavor of the bean, which is completely different than hot coffee, hot brewed coffee. So, arriving at the particular style of roast, just, you know, the particular bean, that's the quandary. You know, how do you pick? Go ahead.
I'd say we usually kind of shy away from darker roasts. I'd say we're usually in the medium to kind of lighter roast range. I think with the danger with the darker roasts is you can kind of get a little too much like intense, roastiness, kind of that kind of unpleasant, bitter coffee character.
That's what I
would. But other than that, it's really just experimentation and playing around and trying it out and seeing what works, is kind of what's worked the best for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and
JD, you said that had some Marionberry in it. Is it a very forward Marionberry?
Oh yeah. No. This is like when you first take a sip, you get instantly this tart Marionberry, followed almost immediately, maybe mid palate, by the coffee. And then the lingering flavor on the tail end goes back to that tart Marionberry.
Okay.
So, and the coffee is not not a slight or a light hint of coffee either. It's definitely coffee, but it comes and it goes, and you're left with this dry tart Marionberry lingering.
So with that one, the coffee Marion, we actually take the Marion mead, and then we just age coffee on it. And so that's something that we do quite often, is we'll take an existing product and add something to it to create something new and different. And that makes it easier for us to kind of get more stuff out there and have a wider selection on the shelf.
Oh yeah.
So I can put some coffee beans in my remainder of this bottle and see what I come up with.
Chris, I would take I would take some of your Heart of Darkness maybe. And of course it might be too sweet, but hey, take some of your Heart of Darkness and throw it in a little quart jar and drop a few coffee beans in it. Let it sit there for a few days and see what happens.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be sweet at all. I think, guys taste that, I think you're going to be extremely surprised that a mead that finished at a final gravity of like 1056 can be so dry. But there again, you're looking at that 7.5 pounds of extremely tart fruit in there. And I think coffee might go just perfect with that, because it's already got some sort of chocolatey notes.
Yeah.
Carlos,
I think that would be great too.
Now, Carlos, when you submit to the Mazer Cup as a professional, are they using essentially the same score sheets that you get as an amateur?
I'm not sure about that.
Is it scored a numerical score out of like a 50?
Yeah. So it's. I'm not sure if it's exactly the BJCP score sheet, but it's pretty similar. If it's not exactly the same.
Well, Chris, so Chris here has made a Heart of Darkness, the Ken Schramm Heart of Darkness. He's made a tribute mead to that. Called Heart Murmur. And what did that score at Mazer Cup, Chris? I forget the exact score.
It was a 45 and a 42, so it was a 45 and a 42.
Yeah.
45 out of 50.
So it scored pretty highly, and we're all eager to try that one. A lot of these meads you sent us have medals on them. And even including this last one that I was sent, this Lagmiris, is that how you say that?
Oh, Lagrimas de Oro.
Yeah, Lagrimas de Oro. This is a mesquite mead aged in a bourbon barrel. And it says that it was a silver medalist in the 2013 Mazer Cup. It's on the bottle here, it says it's off dry. It says enjoy in a chilled glass I'm drinking it at room temperature, but my room temperature is about 65. So maybe that's chilled. I'm really curious about this one. This is a, unlike my compatriot Chris there, I don't like any bit of sweetness at all. I shouldn't, that's a little harsh, but I prefer things on the drier side. Even a lot of times when someone tells me that they've made an off dry mead, I typically say, you know, put it in an aperitif glass and, you know, let's sip it after dinner. But this is extremely balanced. I don't know what it ended at, but it's, I don't have my hydrometer out. It is extremely balanced. It's extremely light in color, a very almost translucent hay color. You know, on the nose, I think I'm getting a little bit of oak or not bourbon, but maybe a little bit of oak and maybe a faint hint of bourbon, but there is, I don't get any of the bourbon on the tongue, much in the nose, and it certainly, you know, the color of it doesn't give me the impression that, you know, it's barrel aged, but it is a magnificent mead. I can see why it got the medal at Maser. It's extremely smooth. It's extremely drinkable. The tannins are balancing against whatever sugar was there. So my question before I let you explain this or within your explanation, I am curious to know how long this was in the barrel and how used the barrel was.
Typically, lager moss is in the barrel for between 3 to 6 months. So we do quite a bit of extended barrel aging for some things that we really want to have, like, you know, a soaked in bourbon character. But lager moss isn't really one of those. You know, we want it to be, like you're saying, balanced and drinkable, and not, we don't want the bourbon to be overwhelming. And so in our old location, just a little bit about kind of what we've just gone through a pretty large growth phase, and we built a production facility that's about 4,000 square feet, and previously we're in a basement with a production space of 400 square feet. So why I'm saying that is that in the basement, we had about 30 barrels, and we had barrels stacked too high, and so if we had barrels on the second level, and we had barrels underneath them, we couldn't move them. So by necessity, we would often reuse our bourbon barrels, you know, two or three times to try to kind of extend the life and not be wasting that space. So these past batches of lager moss that were made in our old space, you know, those were usually a blend of, you know, first use barrels and second or third use barrels as well. Going forwards, we're kind of moving towards using all first use bourbon barrels, because we really like the kind of bourbon character that they give to our meads. But I believe that particular batch that you have was a blend of three or four barrels, and it probably had, you know, one first use barrel, and the other barrels were probably second and third use.
Great. Very good. Carlos, I've got a question. This is something I ask every guest we have on here, and it's purely out of curiosity and information for our listeners. We all preach this basic mead making technique that, and each one of us has a little variation, but we preach, you know, yeast rehydration, good, you know, like degassing twice a day for the first third of the fermentation, temperature control, nutrient additions. Why don't you just give us a rundown on what you consider your, what techniques you use, and like what nutrients do you like to use and things like that?
Yeah, so we do all of that. I think if you're making mead at this point and not doing that, then I kind of think you're doing it wrong. So yeah, we rehydrate our yeast with GoFirm Protect Evolution. So that's specifically a rehydration agent for dry yeast. And so then we're pitching that, and we're heavily oxygenating our must. And so we're doing pretty much exclusively high gravity products. So we try to introduce pretty much as much pure oxygen as we can get into solution. And then our nutrients, we use DAP, diammonium phosphate, and Fermate K. And so we'll add those, you know, when we start the fermentation, and then up to halfway through the fermentation. And then as far as degassing goes, and we only add nutrients once a day and degas once a day. But our whole fermentation management process takes about an hour and a half. So it's not really possible for us to do that twice a day.
Mm-hmm. What kind of fermentation temperatures do you try to maintain?
We're usually shooting for about 75 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, you know, warmer than a lot of people will ferment, you know, beer. But we've kind of found it's kind of the sweet spot to keep yeast real active and fermenting relatively quickly and kind of getting the flavor profile that we're going for.
Okay. And on average, from yeast pitch to bottle and ready to drink, what kind of time do you have?
So on some things, we'll go from pitching yeast to bottling and selling in 2.5 to 3 weeks.
Wow.
Pretty good.
Very good. Carlos, any last bits of advice that you would give the home mead maker?
Yes. So fermentation management, I think, makes the biggest difference between bad mead and good mead and great mead. It makes a huge difference for us. If we weren't actively managing our fermentations, we wouldn't be able to make stuff that quickly, or, you know, it would take a long time for off flavors to age out. And another thing I would say is, there's a lot of dogma out there, you know, people saying you have to do it this way. And I think, you know, that's just not true. I think it's always worth, you know, questioning those kind of accepted practices and trying something new. And, you know, for a long time, people have always been saying it takes, you know, it takes 6 months, it takes a year to make a good mead. And I think that some of the things you guys are drinking right now, you know, that, you know, we made in, you know, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, kind of disprove that.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us, Carlos. Superstitionmeadery.com is the website. And if you're near Prescott, Arizona, tell them the Mead House sent you. Thanks again, Carlos.
Where are you in relation to the Palace Bar?
So our tasting room is kind of kitty corner to that, like on the same block.
Oh, wow.
So our tasting room is awesome. Right downtown on the Courthouse Square in the basement of a historic building. Really cool. If anybody gets a chance to come and check it out, really neat spot. You can see where we started making stuff down there. And then our production facility that we just built is out at the airport, kind of industrial park here in town, about 15, 20 minutes outside of town. And that is not yet open for public tours, but that is something that we're planning on doing.
I spent a lot of time, well, not a lot of time, traveling to and from Prescott for quite a few years. My dad used to own property out there just the other side of the fairgrounds. That was back oh, nice. When it, that was back when it was just a wide spot in the middle of the road, the only thing that town had going for it was their rodeo until Steve McQueen got there and made the Palace Bar famous. So good stuff. And thanks for coming aboard tonight, Carlos. Really enjoyed it.
Well, thanks for having me.
And thank you. The mead also.
Yeah.
And thank you for the meads. Absolutely.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right. I sent the guys a couple of bottles. You know, for the sake of time, I've joked in the past on how, you know, I give away my mistakes because that keeps people from asking me for more. I snuck a few of those into the packages that I sent these guys. So let's... we don't need to talk about those right now, but let's jump. I do want to hear if anyone has had a chance to try. I sent the guys two different bottles. One of them was Arrhythmia, which is a derivative of Heart Murmur, which is a derivative of Heart of Darkness. So this was a session strength mead that was carbonated and made from, I believe, wildflower honey and a blend of tart cherries, raspberries, and black currants. Who had a chance to try that bottle?
Me.
I've tried it as well.
I've been waiting because I wanted to make sure it was carbonated perfectly.
It's time.
Is it time?
Okay. Oh yeah, it's time.
JD, what was your impression of that one?
Well, it made a terrific when I opened it up for sure. So I thought it was a little overly carved my first sip because that's all I got was nothing but bubbles on my tongue. I couldn't taste anything else, but. I let it sit out for a little while until it finally calmed down, but it reminded me of it's kind of blood red. It's nice and clear. I thought it was just a little tad too much carbonation. When it was cold, I got no honey aroma whatsoever at all. In fact, I didn't get hardly anything out of it when it was cold, but when it came up to about 50, 60 degrees, boy, the honey really started coming through, smelled rather nice. And then you get this, it's kind of a, you know, not one single berry, and to smell it, the aroma, you couldn't pinpoint a particular berry. It just smelled like berry, dry, very dry, tart. I thought maybe too tart. Almost cranberry, dry cranberry-ish is what my first thought was. And I don't know if there's any cranberry in it or not, but I did get some raspberry for sure. It's got a very long, lingering tartness on the tongue and on the backside. And kind of a sour aftertaste, I guess. Maybe that's the tartness that I got. Just reading from my notes. Tartness gets in the way of the flavor. I wrote that down, too. So, but you could tell it was some kind of berry right in the middle after you get to get over the carbonation. Why you get past the tartness. You can pick. I got raspberry. I got red currant also for some reason. That's my take.
You know, I'm trying mine right now. I've got mine out. So go ahead. Whoever else has tried it, you go ahead and I'll give me time to taste it here.
I was just going to jump in.
Aaron.
The description of that, JD, it sounds like it would be the perfect mead to blend with sweet cherry melmel that I did a ways back that was just – I back-sweetened it. I got a little carried away and went overboard with back-sweetening with too much honey, and it's just cloyingly sweet. But I have found that by cutting that with like a drier sparkling mead, you really can achieve something quite delightful. And just the way that you're describing it as being, you know, very, very tart, almost to the point where it, I forget exactly how you worded that, like starts to get in the way a little bit with the flavor, that might be just the perfect thing to cut into that sweet cherry that I did.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
Oh, Jeff? Man, this is good. I like this. So, yeah, so looking at this, it has a really good color, really nice presentation. I get a lot of the berry on mid-palate. I think JD was saying that. And off front, it has that really nice crispness with the carbonation and the dryness. I kind of get where JD's coming from with the it's not tartness that's getting in the way for me. It's almost an astringency on this one that's really bothering me. And I like dry meats as well, so I think it just may be a little bit out of balance for what I like. It may be going a little too far in that direction while still being dry, but that's kind of where I lay on it. It has that little astringent puckery bite to it. That right at the end, that kind of that sours it a little bit for me too.
I was kind of wondering how you would, as I sat there drinking it, I kept thinking, how could you lower the tartness yet hang on to the berry flavor and not make it any more sweeter? I like the dryness. I loved it. You know, I like that in a mead. But anyway.
While we think about that, Chris, what did you think?
Well, imagine that I'm the one out of all the people here who are going to advocate a dry mead. This is when you're working with tart fruit like this, this is about as good as you're going to get by taking it dry. And I'm drinking this at room temperature because I was concerned that it wasn't carbed yet, but it's about 65 degrees right now, so I'm just getting a lot of berry flavor, but it's not like a searing dryness or anything. The Heart of Darkness, or the Heart Murmur, I should say, is a tart mead. It's inherently tart. You just simply can't use that kind of fruit in any amount whatsoever without getting some tartness. And so I fully expected that. Maybe you guys didn't expect it, but when you start putting black currants in something, it's going to get tart real quick. But I like that. This is not—it's not like searing dry, and it's not extremely astringent, although it is there. I mean, for a session strength carbonated mead version of the Heart Murmur, you nailed it. It's right on the money, and I wouldn't hesitate to drink this anytime. And I'm not a fan of dry meads, but I still like it. So, I think you did an excellent
job. JD, the recorder better be on because I need to play that clip over and over again.
Yeah. I can cut it out and make it repeat itself about 10 times if you want.
Hey, guys, listen, I told you I'm not a fan of dry meads at all. But every dry mead that I've gotten so far from you guys have been perfectly drinkable. I mean, I would drink them. Aaron, Ryan, and Jeff, and I think maybe JD has sent a dry one. But every one I've gotten has been something I would drink. And so, hey, it's just another testament, I think, to the group of guys we got together here.
Hear, hear. The second mead that I sent everyone that wasn't intended to get them to stop asking me was an oaked hibiscus sizer. Now, this one as well, this started out as just apple juice and honey, went through primary fermentation as just like that, added a hibiscus tea in that I made with dried hibiscus leaves and boiling water, added that to secondary. And then after fermentation had ended, added some oak chips and put the oak chips in for a spell. JD and Jeff, I think you guys both might have tried these.
Not yet. I'm on my way to the refrigerator right now, so go, Jeff.
Okay, so this is hitting on so many good levels for me. I really love cider or sizer with a nice tart element to it, and this definitely has this from the hibiscus. For whatever reason, I'm not getting a lot of oak from it. Until you just reminded me of it, and I've got a glass here open tasting it. I guess the oak comes across a little bit, but it's not readily apparent. I don't know that it adds a lot to it with the strong flavor of the hibiscus. My major complaint is that right at the finish, I get a little bit of a vegetal flavor that I think is from the hibiscus, and I wonder if that's not from the tea process. The combination of the apple and the tartness really works for me really well. And the carbonation level, the bottle carb, I hit it right on the spot. It's really sharp. It has a really nice crisp finish. So it's great.
I'll take that.
Somebody helping Daddy pour another glass.
Ryan, I got to tell you something. If you entered this in a competition, my bottle would have been disqualified because I just got a major gusher. Like, major.
Ryan loves the carbonated meads.
You know, actually, in this one, I should say that Chris, I'm sorry, and JD, if you haven't opened yours, be careful.
I got it. Yeah.
This one I carbonated the priming sugar that I used was 2 cans in the 5 gallon batch. It's a 5 gallon batch. 2 cans of thawed frozen concentrated apple juice.
Oh, really?
And
I think my bottle got all of it.
And that's
I had a lot of. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and I did, use a paddle, a sanitized paddle, to kind of stir that in a little bit to in the bottling bucket. Maybe the sugar calculation was off, or maybe it wasn't stirred in properly. Chris, send JD your dry cleaning bill.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Hold on a second. What kind of oak did you use in this?
American oak.
Yeah.
Medium toast or something?
That would have been.
Going heavy or medium plus or something.
Yeah, I think it might have been medium.
Because this is like bourbon. This is JD's bourbon. Big time.
Yeah, I'm getting oak. Definitely. Now mine is refrigerator cold, so all I'm getting is hibiscus, oak, and lots of carbonation. I don't get any apple at all. Maybe that'll come as it comes to temperature, room temperature, or whatever. But
what I'm tasting here is a carbonated bourbon. I mean, I don't know. I don't know exactly what you did or how much oak, but if you ever make a mead and you're looking to get a bourbon flavor in it, do whatever you did with this.
That's got a, you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of, as I turn around and look, I can't see the labels. I have a bourbon up there that it's very light in color. And light in color means that it hasn't spent a whole lot of time in a barrel. And I get that. So, I got to agree with Chris.
It's got that, you know how some bourbon has a strong vanilla character to it?
Yeah.
It's got that.
But no, this is
really, really bourbon.
Yeah, this is the other side. This is the other side of that. This is a new barrel. This is one that the bourbon hasn't sat in it for very long at all. Probably blended with something else to keep it light.
I don't know what the ABV on this is, but I'm just judging. Maybe it's the bourbon character playing with my mind, but I'm just guessing that this one would put you on your ass pretty quick.
That's so that's coming in at about 8% ABV.
Yeah, and the arrhythmia, what was it?
The arrhythmia was about
lower.
That one was a little closer to 6.
Yeah.
And this was this was American oak chips of new oak.
New oak.
And I don't know what that I'm not seeing a toasting level on it. It's labeled as new oak.
New oak's going to be lightly charred. That's a new oak barrel.
Yeah.
Ryan, I mean, it's good for what it is. And it's really good for what it is, but you know me.
Well,
bourbon.
That's all I hope. That's all I hope that my wife tells me, Ryan, you're good for what you are.
Yeah, I mean that's the best we can hope for.
What did Aaron get this one?
Aaron's gonna get all of it. He just doesn't have it right now.
Okay.
You know, this has got, and I think this is coming from the oak also. There's a certain creaminess to it. Do you guys get that? Not necessarily a creamy mouthfeel, but just a creamy quality.
That may be the hibiscus. I get that herbal, almost tea-like. I'm thinking apple. I got apple on the brain, but I can't get there. I get this herbal. It's definitely hibiscus.
I can't get anything but
and
bourbon.
I get that light. I get that light bourbon. Maybe it's a combination of things that playing with your mind here.
Ryan, you could market this. I mean, really. And you know I'm not a fan of bourbon, and you know I'm not a fan of dry meads, but there's a lot of bourbon drinkers out there who would snatch this up.
If you could tone down the carbonation in this just a notch,
that we can do.
Yep.
See, and I thought the carbonation was right where it needed to be. I mean, it was high for me too. I thought it helped.
Yeah.
I thought it made a pleasant like initial mouthfeel. I mean, like the amount that I poured into this glass maybe filled it halfway, but the foam came all the way to the top. That might have helped too. It might have dissipated some of the carbonation that way before I drank it. But the high carbonation worked for me in that regard. It tasted good. It had a nice like initial bite to it that I thought helped.
Great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, every time I get mead from you guys, I'm just impressed as hell. I mean, it's good stuff.
Want to talk about the coffee ones?
if you want to say something about it, I'm not going to cut you off.
I just drank 287 milliliter bottles. I don't think I need another one.
No, you know what? You could probably use those coffee ones out in your leather working studio to maybe stain the leather or something. That'd be a good use for them. One.
Oh, you already tried them?
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. One had this sour. I thought, holy shit, am I going to get sick? I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to puke. It had this sourness to it, like sour. I mean, sour coffee. Oh, my God. I took one swallow, and that was down the sink it went. The other one had, I don't know what was going on with it. I mean, what did you put in that stuff besides coffee?
Well, what'd you get? What did you think you were getting?
I thought it was gonna be a coffee mead, something like, you know, the stuff that I made here myself and threw down the sink.
Wait, guys, don't give it away. Wait till we all get to try it before you give away any secrets.
Yeah.
All right.
Let's wait till everybody's got a shot at this, because it's going to be an experience for sure.
I'm going to turn it over to JD. Why don't you walk us through the surface of Mars in a carboy?
well, this is a stout, and it's been sitting. Well, this actually involves you, Ryan. This is that project that I had started quite a while back, the stout. And remember, it had stopped fermenting at, you know, and it didn't finish fermenting. And I don't have my notebook in front of me right now, because I don't recall what yeast. I think it was a Danstar yeast. But it stopped. And so we kind of talked about it, and we decided that let's throw some more honey at it. It was only like 3%. After time, so we kind of knew that, you know, tossing in some more yeast wasn't gonna, you know, there wasn't enough alcohol in there to kill the yeast. So tossed in some more honey. I don't remember how much, not a whole lot, and then tossed in some more yeast, and it finally started chugging back to life. And so it finished out, and I think we came to something like a 7 or 8% ABV on it, which is fine. I don't recall the gravity on it. Well, that's probably going to be a little hard to determine. But unless somebody wants to do the math, I'll have to look the numbers up. But I believe it's something around 7 or 8% ABV. So it sat in the corner. It had some cocoa nibs and some coffee beans in it. And over time, I noticed this. Now you'll have to go on the Facebook page. I think I put it on our Facebook page. If I didn't send a picture around, but it's got these bubbles. It looks like the surface of some unknown planet in some other galaxy. And so I thought, well, this is kind of weird looking. So I wonder what the hell this is. So I put it up on a Mead Maker's Facebook page. And I mean, that day, there's like, I don't know, Ryan, what do you say? There's like 50 frickin' responses.
There's 50 responses, and there's a lot of good guesses, but I don't think we're at consensus yet.
Well, a lot of people saying that this is some kind of a Brett infection.
That would be my guess as well.
Yeah, but doesn't that now? You know, I don't know anything about Brett or sours or anything, and this is what a lot of people were alluding to. And that generally may not be a bad thing. And so I thought, well, what the hell? You only live once. So I stuck my wine thief down in it and pulled me out a sample and downed about a quarter cup full of it. And it tastes pretty good. It smells good. Smells like a stout. It's got kind of a very, very light, very light chocolate to coffee kind of aroma going to it. I can pick it up in the taste. It wasn't sour. It didn't taste bad. Nothing unusual whatsoever. Nothing. So
I'm going with a Brett Pellicle, and I think if you leave it alone, it's going to get sour.
Well,
Brett?
Go ahead. Well,
I was going to say, Brett is interesting in that it, if you leave it for a really long time, it develops an extremely distinctive Brett flavor. How long it takes to get there is probably dependent on, you know, the type of Brett and the environment it's in. But a little bit of Brett, it can almost be undetectable. And Brett under pressure can be is very desirable. There's a Belgian ale. I think it's called Duvel. And if they're not all this way, at least certain Duvels are, in that they're bottle conditioned with the Brett. And so, you know, the beer is finished, it's done, and then they inoculate with Brett and they bottle. And that Brett that develops under pressure, or that conditions the beer under pressure, gives it a very distinct and very desirable flavor that apparently only occurs when Brett is under pressure. So there's a lot of things that you can do with it, but you probably, and I think Chris was saying this, you probably won't notice any real distinct Brett flavors unless you let it sit for quite some time, or, well, at least a little while.
Well, Clifford Capizzuto on the Facebook page, he wrote, he commented, he says that, looks like the yeast that develops on top of stuff like opened homemade beet pickles forgotten in the back of the pantry. What I did do is I couldn't find for the life of me, I don't know, you know, frozen cherries, like cherry season over or what. The store that I shop at, our local Ralph's, and it's a huge, one of these new modern Ralph's, I mean, it's a huge store, usually has frozen tart cherries, bags of them. So wouldn't you know it, I go back, you know, to get some tart cherries, and they don't have any. So I got three cans of tart cherries, just plain tart cherries in water, no preservatives, no nothing. And so I dumped two cans in, along with some extra cocoa nibs. Of course, that destroyed the odd looking surface, and at the suggestion of one of the people, I don't remember who it was on Facebook. Forgive me if you are listening to the show. I don't recall what your name is. It might have been Carvin of all people. So I did that. Filled the now everything that I do, I top them all up with CO2. And I do that if it's something I aged, for a lengthy period, I'll pull the airlock off and give it a couple more shots of CO2 and put the airlock back on it just to make sure. Everything I got, I mean, even this, sat on top of some CO2. So I'm just going to let it sit there for, another couple of months or whatever. And sit on those cherries and that chocolate, and we'll taste it here in a couple months and see what it tastes like.
That sounds really good. I think you got a better chance of that being good than bad.
Well, I mean, this is if it looks bad, smells bad, I mean, it's going down the sewer and help clean the sewers of L.A. And I'm sometimes a little too quick on doing that. The four of you have often said, hey, wait, let it sit. Chris, especially, he's done that a couple of times to me. Don't throw it out. Just let it sit. Let it age. Put it away. Don't think about it. I thought, well, before I do anything because of this strange-looking growth, you know, I'll put it up on the Facebook over at the Mead Makers and see what other people think. And I mean, at that day, I was surprised at the number of people who responded to it. A couple of people in there, and again, I think it was you, Carvin, might have suggested the fruit thing. It may have been somebody else. I apologize, you know, if it wasn't you, and to the person who it was, if you're listening to the show. But thank you for the advice. Thanks to everybody at the Mead Makers Facebook page. Appreciate it. We're going to see what happens.
JD, you know, it's a fairly common held belief, and rightfully so. Once a beverage has fully fermented, whether it's beer, mead, wine, or whatever, there's very little harmful things that can actually infect and grow in there. So not to say that it can't happen, but there's not going to be very many harmful things out there. So if you do make something and you end up with an infection like this, it might be worth looking into, and maybe, you know, depending on the situation, you might want to go ahead and rack out from under it and then sulfide it. But on the other hand, you might want to just let it ride a while and see what develops, because, you know, chances are you're not going to have something harmful.
Yeah, right now, obviously, all the little bubbles have dissipated. They're no longer there after I put the cherries, and that was a very delicate operation too, because I didn't want to introduce a lot of, you know, oxygen into it. So it was like, you know, gently putting cherries down this little 1-inch hole. You know, and trying not to disturb it too much. And of course, I had my CO2 gun there. You know, drop a few cherries, squirt some CO2, drop a few cherries, squirt some CO2. But the bubbles are gone. So, and they haven't come back.
But now you know, asked me, JD, you said where, you know, you were talking to me on text and you said, well, yeah, where in the world did it come from? And I said, my suggestion was 99% chance it came from oak. I would be willing to bet that it did.
There was, and I think there was some oak in it.
Can you drop some?
It's been racked once, and I think there was some oak in it the first time around, because it's been racked from the original carboy to another carboy. When I added the honey, we put the honey in the new carboy first, got it all kind of mixed up real good, and then, you know, slowly racked the old carboy into the new carboy. And I think the old carboy did have some oak.
Mm-hmm. I bet that's where it came from.
You know, and to Chris's point, if it was only 3% alcohol when it was racked, that might not have been enough to, you know, take care of anything, you know, that was down there. Like, you know, if I've got a 10% mead and I drop in some fruit or some spice, I'm not overly concerned about what's on it, you know, but, yeah, 3%, it might have not been enough.
Well, that was the 3%, Ryan, was when you and I had talked. That's right. All it had gotten to. And then at that point is when we added more honey to it and introduced some more yeast in a new carboy. And that's when it started, it took off and started fermenting. So
yeah.
In the new carboy, there is no oak. There's only coffee bean and cocoa nibs. So,
okay.
But if you had a period of time where you were very low in alcohol, it was probably long enough to give something a foothold.
Yeah.
I could share my own anecdote.
Yeah.
This is, I actually dealt with something similar to this, not with me, but with beer. I tried to make a very basic IPA recipe from Charlie Papazian's, like, Complete Guide to Homebrewing, or was it Joy of Homebrewing, I think? Yeah, that's Joy of Homebrewing. Yeah, and so I used one of his basic recipes, but, you know, his basic recipes are formulated to, I think, Colorado, where he's from, and they use gypsum. I'm in Kansas, and we already have pretty hard water. So between the gypsum that I added because it was on his recipe list, and the calcium carbonate that's already just dissolved in all of our tap water, I end up with a really low acidity mead. And I think something got into it, especially towards the end of fermentation, because it developed a pellicle similar, but not exactly the same as the one you got. And, you know, I stuck the wine cave underneath it. I tasted it. And by God, it tastes like a good IPA. I was using the Falconer's Flight Blend of hops, which are a little bit on the pricey side, but they, by God, they taste great. And, you know, I figured it was worth a shot. So I still bottled it because it was done fermenting. And just tried to bottle off the pellicle, or bottle from under the pellicle. All of the bottles started developing pellicles of their own. And so my wife was like, no, you're not keeping this. This is gross. and she pitched all but like a dozen of them. I convinced her to let me try a dozen of them for my own usage, just for science and experimentation's sake, to see what happened. I let them sit in the cabinet for a month and a half, 2 months. The pellicle was gone. It didn't sink. It was just gone. I don't know what exactly happened to that, but I tasted it, and it was great. So, yeah, it would have taken a little while to age that off. It might not have been ready for a wedding like I'd intended it to when I brewed it, but, you know, still good beer.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling, as far gone as yours is already, you're gonna wind up with something similar. It's probably still gonna be good beer, good mead.
Well, but, you know, it tasted good, Jeff. That was one thing that threw me, because, you know, when you look at it, it looks like holy shit, this is like science project from hell. Put on your rubber gloves before you touch it. And yet when I pulled a sample out, there was no off smell, no nothing. I mean, it smelled and tasted completely normal. Like, I mean, there was no unusual aromas, no unusual flavors, nothing. So.
Right.
Well, and you go back
I think part of that. Sorry. What I was going to say is that part of that may also be that, you know, you are keeping a pretty good head of CO2 on top of it. If it is Brett is mainly aerobic bacteria, so it needs the oxygen to do its full metabolism. Keeping that head of CO2 on top of it may be seriously preventing it from doing much of anything that it wants to be doing, too.
Yeah.
I think you're backwards on that, if I'm not mistaken, Jeff, because that's the purpose of the pellicle, is to keep out oxygen. I think with Brett, you want to avoid oxygen at all costs.
Actually, I pulled up the let's see, what organization is this from?
Well, what'd you find?
Well, I looked up beer spoilage organisms. This is from some college because it's got an EDU domain. And it's telling me that the Brettanomyces is aerobic. I understand what you're saying with the pellicle being to keep out oxygen. That was my understanding as well. So that this may not be correct. I don't know, to be perfectly honest. It's been so long since I've looked into Brett my own self. I could be wrong.
Well, we want to give our listeners good information, so we'll look it up and tell you next time.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And with that, let's wrap this up. We're going to turn the porch light off, shut the door. You don't have to stay home, but you can't stay here. Mead House will be open next Wednesday, when we come back.
We'll have something special for you next week on July 25th. Susan Rude of Prairie Rose Meadery will join us, and we'll get to chat with her about some of her stuff. Always let us know what you think. Visit us online, themeathouse.com. Drop us a note. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. Anything but a pigeon. We will see you next week.
All right. Perfect. Good night, guys.